Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, and we're here until 5 a.m. Nick DiGiulio here, and 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And we're going to jump into the movie reviews here, too, talking about the new movies this week. And then, Erica stick around, and we will talk box office as well. So, our phone number is 312-981-7200. And we're going to bust out the scary sound CD, everybody. Get ready. Prepare yourself for the lovely tradition. So that's coming up. Let's talk about the movies, though. The brand new movies, Eric Childress, Colin Suter, they join me every week to talk about the new releases. And then we'll talk box office as well. So let's welcome the guys to the show. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's get right to it. Eric, why don't you tell us about The Guilty?
Okay, this is a Danish film that premiered at Sundance this year and was part of our Chicago Critics Film Festival in May. It's a story of a police dispatcher who has kind of been demoted for some incident that we don't have all the details on, but he's sort of being punished, so he is relegated to dispatcher duty. And this movie, the story takes place over the course of a single evening as we watch him not just interact with his colleagues that he has some, you know, the differences with, but also the various calls that he takes. You know, we kind of watch him kind of not exactly be the, you know, most 911 dispatchers you call and they, you know, they help you through a problem or they, you know, they get on it right away. This guy is sometimes a little more judgmental. He sometimes delays help when sometimes people need it due to bad decisions that they've made. But then he gets a real pickle of a call involving a woman who may be in some certain danger. He's determined to help her out, figure out exactly what is going on with her, the details of which I do not want to divulge too much of. But it's as this movie takes the story unfolds over the course of this evening, we discover that there's more to not just this call, but also what's going on in this guy's personal life. Sort of led him to this moment. They kind of converge in a way. This is a really striking feature. It's not just all about what goes down with this call and, you know, the various, you know, instances of suspense that that kind of just build up as a result of this thing. There, you know, so they lose touch every once in a while, trying to get a hold of her or get back in touch with her and find out exactly where she might be. So it has a mystery element to it, but that's only kind of part of the story. There's, you know, something much deeper going on here about human nature and how we kind of judge each other. It's a really well put together film, just under 90 minutes long. It brisks along, and it's the kind of movie that, you know, it seems like it's going to go one direction, but it's actually, you know, going for something a lot more interesting about human nature. It's a really good film called The Guilty.
Okay, and that's it's at the Siskel Center. If people want to check it out, it's at the Siskel Center. So there you go. And that was it. You said it was at Sundance.
Yeah, premiered at Sundance, and then we brought it to the Music Box in May.
Wow. Okay. Cool. All right. Colin, did you see it?
Yeah, I did, and I agree. It's an excellent film, and it's kind of belongs in that same genre or whatever you want to call it of, you know, these kind of one man show movies like the one Tom Hardy was in a while ago,
right.
And then the 127 Hours. It's like that kind of, or Buried with Ryan Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
Like that kind of movie. It's just one actor basically you're watching through most of it, and yeah, it's really good.
All right, cool. So that's The Guilty, and you can see it at the Siskel Center, and a couple of good reviews right there. All right. Colin, why don't you tell us about Free Solo?
All right. Well, it would seem that this is just another documentary about mountain climbing, and we've had a few of those over the years. We had actually one this year called Mountain, which I reviewed a few months ago. But this one is more personal in a kind of man-on-wire sort of way. It's about a guy named Alex Honnold, who does what is called free solo climbing, which is climbing without the aid of a rope or pulleys or any of that stuff. It's just basically you and the rock. So it's, you know, one of the toughest rocks to climb in this fashion is El Capitan in Yosemite. And it becomes an obsession for him to conquer this. It's an obsession for a lot of climbers to want to conquer this thing. So the filmmakers follow this guy for, I think, a year or maybe longer or a little shorter, but they spend a lot of time with him as he practices with a rope. And tries to give it a go, but then decides not to, and all while enjoying his first real relationship with a woman who understands why he does what he does. It's part of why she fell in love with him, but also really can't bear to watch, much like us in the audience at times. But it's interesting to see how she changes him and makes him kind of a better person, and that's what this movie's really about. It really is about how he, you know, has kind of gone through his life, just sort of, you know, having these kinds of obsessions of doing these kinds of things, and then having somebody come along and just kind of ground him a little bit and make him realize, like, there's more important things in life. But nevertheless, there's, you know, he's one of these guys who's just not going to be happy until he tries this thing and conquers it. So that's what I mean when it's kind of like a man on wire sort of thing. There's just something drawing him to this and to get it done. And so, you know, like a lot of mountain climbing documentaries or movies, there's a lot of perilous moments in it. There are a lot of scenes that are just, you're on the edge of your seat, your palms are sweaty. And the last 20 minutes of this movie is certainly no exception. I mean, this is very much like watching Man on Wire or even The Walk again in 3D IMAX, although this is not 3D or IMAX. Certainly kind of should feel that way.
Yeah.
And I like that it's more of a personal film, and it's not just this guy in this mountain. There's a lot more going on. We really do learn a lot about this guy. We really like him, and we kind of root for him. And, you know, we also root for his girlfriend, who is doing her best to, like, you know, keep him grounded a little bit. And so you really get the dramatic effect of this whole thing, really what it means and what's at stake. And while also kind of being on the edge of your seat. So this is one that I very much recommend. Uh-huh. And on the big screen, if you can.
It's, yeah. It's playing at Music Box, River East, the Arclight, Century in Evanston, in Northbrook, and Marcus Addison Cinema. So it's playing in 6 theaters, so that's cool.
Yeah. That's a big ringing endorsement for a documentary.
Yeah. All right. I would probably freak out. Because I'm not real good.
Yeah.
I'm not real good with the heights.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. So that's Free Solo, and that's out right now too. All right, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Colin are here, and they join me every Monday morning to review the new movies. When we come back, we got more movies to review, and then Eric's going to stick around, and we'll talk box office as well. So that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, and it's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to unearth the scary sound CD. We're going to talk about the old Sears catalog. Yeah, part of that and much more here. And the phone lines are 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/Nick D Show. So, yes, and it is time for the movie reviews. Let's get back to it. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning to talk movies. And then Eric's going to stick around, and we'll talk box office after that. So let's get the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, tell us about The Oath.
Okay, well, this is the directorial debut of comedian and actor Ike Barinholtz, who also stars in the movie, along with Tiffany Haddish, who plays his wife. And it's a story of a guy that is living in the United States, wherein they have a president who has asked the country to sign a loyalty oath. Again, this is fiction. Needless to say, he has a very liberal mindset and is no interest in being a part of this. He believes it is against his First Amendment rights. But, you know, he's kind of slowly sees the people around him, people he works with, people he knows, particularly members of his own family, who are willing to sign this pledge. There's no necessary punishment for not signing the pledge, but people who do will get, you know, certain amenities from their taxes and benefits and things like that. So the movie is set right around the few of the days right before and after Thanksgiving, which leads to a very tense family dinner. We all hear about the Thanksgivings from hell, but this movie actually features one because it involves, as many families do, differing politics. Him and his wife are very liberal-leaning. His parents are a little more conservative. His brothers, played by his actual brother, is incredibly conservative, and he brings with him kind of a dingbat girlfriend with him who's even worse. But he does have a liberal sister, played by Carrie Brownstein, who is there to sort of calm the waters a little bit. And so this movie then takes even further turns when a couple of government officials, played by John Cho and Billy Magnuson from Game Night, show up, and after having received a complaint about Barinholtz's character possibly coercing someone to not sign the loyalty oath. Needless to say, this is a comedy, and it turns into a very dark comedy at times, and it's one that I enjoyed pretty immensely, actually. I was laughing quite a bit during this film. This is a film that is certainly very much about our times. While, you know, He Who Should Not Be Named is not named in the film, it's very much a fictional president. You know, everything that's going on in this country right now is just steaming from the screen and everything that goes on. You know, sometimes, you know, the dialogue sometimes is very on the nose. You know exactly what team you are on while you're watching this movie. And I think this movie, you know, has a number of some great satiric stuff going on in it. It's not just an us versus them kind of thing. It actually kind of, you know, leans a little bit that sometimes, you know, paranoid liberals can get a little too paranoid for their own good. But then also kind of shows, you know, how stupid one side can be over the other. And I think Barinholtz, who has increasingly been funnier and funnier, I think, in many movies. You know, he practically stole Blockers earlier this year.
I think
he's got a great handle on this material. I mean, it sometimes you kind of want it to go further. It has kind of a structure to it that, since it goes kind of day by day, you're not exactly sure where this thing is actually headed. I saw the movie without having seen a single frame from a trailer or anything, so I wasn't quite sure where it was going. And it does kind of find that comedic, you know, block where it kind of wraps itself up maybe a little too neatly. But I think it ends on a really positive note, even though this film does take some extremely dark turns, and, you know, it kind of gets you to the point where you just kind of wonder about yourself, just, you know, how far, you know, how much can you take before you are going to snap about everything that's going on in this country. I think this movie takes you up to a point you kind of go, yeah, that would probably make me do it too. So it's kind of like, you know, watching a comedic version of The Purge, in a way, and considering that those movies are garbage and Ike Barinholtz can be pretty funny, I had a really great time with this movie.
Okay. All right. That's The Oath, and that's playing right now. And so is he a decent director?
he's fine. I mean, I don't think he does anything, too fancy or anything. I think he's, it's more about the script and the performances. Nora Dern plays his mother. So he's having a great time with the cast. Tiffany Haddish, I think, is perfectly balanced in this movie. I'm not a fan of hers, but I think that, he knows how to direct her. I'll say that much. Mm-hmm. And he gets a really balanced performance out of her. And I think John Cho is hilarious in this movie. Absolutely hilarious. And Billy Magnuson, very scary in this movie.
All right. Okay, that's The Oath, and it's out right now. And Eric liked it. Okay. Colin, why don't you tell us about Halloween?
All right. Well, this is not a remake or a reimagining, but rather a direct sequel to the original, as if those other ones never happened. So maybe it's a reimagining of H2O from 1998, which also had Jamie Lee Curtis reprising a role as Laurie Strode. But nope, we're starting over yet again. And now she's 40 years removed from the night Michael Myers attacked her, and has spent the last, 30 or so years prepping her family and her grandkids and the eventual eventuality that Michael Myers will show up again. And at the start of the film, he is in an institution, and he gets paid a visit by a couple of journalists who are reinvestigating the murders that Myers, committed 40 years ago. And he eventually escapes this place and makes his way back to Haddonfield, Illinois, where the original took place, and where Laurie Strode's family lives. There's her granddaughter who goes to high school and all of her friends, so the series or genre doesn't lose that teenager vibe that is so important. And, it's all just kind of building up to Halloween night and, the return of Michael Myers, the style mayhem. Except that mayhem is kind of by the numbers in this one. In fact, very by the numbers. This is directed by David Gordon Green, who at one time was a favorite director of mine. Had since walked that back over the last 10 years, although he's had some very good films since then, some very not good films. And this, unfortunately, belongs in the very not good film. The problem with this, I mean, it's got many problems, but this is from a screenplay that Green co-wrote with Danny McBride, of all people. And the last time they collaborated on something was Your Highness, which was also made for Universal Pictures, and I'm kind of surprised they let him back in the door after that. And so this has been kind of one of those really frustrating Hollywood collaborations of the last 10 years, because David Gordon Green is an immensely talented director and Danny McBride is an immensely not talented writer. And you can see that in this, because, one of the basic problems in this movie is a screenplay. And I never really bought that Jamie Lee Curtis was going on 40 years without any incidents of Michael Myers and still obsessing over it. It doesn't track. She's had a couple divorces, they say. She's got, a couple kids. Her life has changed dramatically in the course of these 40 years, and yet we're still expected to believe that she's completely obsessed with, the whole Michael Myers thing. In fact, there's even a character in the movie who early on says, 40 years, a lot has happened, and this is not that big of a deal. And it's kind of hard to disagree with him at times in this case. And another thing, David Gordon Green has a very distinct directorial style, if you know his films. And he tries to bring that style in certain scenes in this movie that you can tell he wrote. And it's a great style. It's one of the things I love about his work. It's so unexpected and quirky and really cool, but it doesn't belong in horror. I mean, that's the thing. It just doesn't belong in this genre. The type of dialogue he writes, the type of performances he likes to get from people, the improvisational nature of his style, it just doesn't work here. And, there's a lot of things that don't work here. It's never really very scary. It's very by the numbers. So he doesn't really bring much in the way of new horror to it. There's a nice tracking shot that he does that I really liked, and I so on a technical level, there are moments that I appreciate about the film. But really, this is a re whatever you call it that just does not work. And really, again, pains me to say that about this director. But yeah, this was another failure for him.
Yeah, I'm wondering what he would have done with Suspiria now that we've got the other remake that's coming out. Eric, Colin, hang on, guys. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, when we come back, we'll get Eric's take on Halloween, and I will tell you what I thought of it as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back with more on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We are here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. That's all coming up, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Okay, we are talking movies, as we do every Monday morning, and before the break, Colin told us about Halloween, the new Halloween, and he didn't like it. And let's get the other guys back here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello there.
All right. Now, Eric, you reviewed this. Where'd you see it? You saw it at...
Saw it at Toronto, where it had a midnight premiere, and I was there for it. And I think I texted you immediately after walking out of the movie.
Yes, you did.
And I think I just texted you one word, and that word was boo.
Right.
Obviously, I wasn't trying to scare you, although yeah. It was probably a more effective scare tactic than anything happens in this movie. You know... 40 years aside, Halloween is still a masterpiece. Whether or not it scares a new generation, that's their, burden to bear. Briefly summarize, some of the things that I said at the film festival. I don't think David Gordon Green and Dan McBride understand what makes Halloween work. And if they do, then they studied the Rob Zombie version more than they did the John Carpenter version, because frankly, they didn't make a Halloween movie, they made a Friday the 13th movie, right down to the dumb numbskull fodder for blood that is going to be throughout the movie. And even mentioning the word blood shows you that they have a fundamental misunderstanding of what makes that film work. Now, again, maybe for a new generation you need to bring the gore, as they say, but you don't need to bring it to a sense that you have Jason Voorhees running around and not Michael Myers. Michael Myers does not crush heads with his foot, and that happens in this movie. And that's at the tail end of a moment of a scene where I pretty much checked out for good on this movie. And it was basically just sitting there for the rest of the movie waiting for the climax to happen, because, okay, so we've been waiting 40 years, so to speak, if you throw out all the other sequels, for this moment, and they even fail to deliver on that. The climax of this movie is utterly unspectacular. I'm no fan of Halloween H2O, but at least that, that the climax of the movie felt like something. It felt like they were trying to, give, some serious closure to it. I'm glad Colin brought up the idea of, the Laurie Strode character and 40 years of misery that she's gone through, because I think that this movie also misses a seriously genuine opportunity to use that storyline as a commentary on the Me Too movement. This movie was put into production at some point after all this stuff happened, and to have a woman who has been carrying around 40 years of trauma, and like Colin said, it doesn't really track in this movie. It doesn't really feel that way. It feels like a necessity more than something that actually feels in her soul a part of her character. It feels like a gimmick. Really, it feels like just, let's just make her Sarah Connor. Okay, let's make her a survivalist. And none of that really works. Like I said, the climax, even if it's just going to be an action climax, is utterly unspectacular. She seems pretty calm. You know, she has guns and she seems pretty calm. You know, she might be crazy to her family, but other than that, Colin's absolutely right. That whole subplot does not track. This is a real failure on their part, and it's disturbing that I don't know why. This movie has garnered, you know, some of the passes that it is getting because it's a pretty terrible film, and I was really disappointed. When I said boo, I texted you boo, Nick, I meant every letter of it.
Yeah.
And I will continue to say that very loudly to people who tell me that this is a good movie, because it's not.
No, it isn't. You guys obviously know what the movie Halloween means to me and how important and a life-changing movie it was for me and still holds up. I mean, it's still one of the greatest horror movies ever made. And the greatness of that movie is its simplicity. That's one of the reasons why it works so well. It's just a real simple setup. The Michael Myers character is just evil. It's a personification of evil. Any kind of backstory that they've tried to bring to it in any of the sequels just doesn't work at all. I really was hoping this was going to be good. And when I first heard about it, I didn't think it was a great idea. And then when I saw the first trailer, because the first trailer was great, and then I got excited about it and I heard, you know, like positive buzz about it. But this is terrible. This is a bad Halloween movie, a really bad Halloween movie. I happen to be a really big fan of H2O. I think H2O is a pretty terrific movie. And I think Jamie Lee Curtis is great in H2O. And, you know, the suffering of 20 years makes more sense than 40. And so, you know what I mean? And it just seems like 20 years, I can understand that. And you know, she had an alcohol problem. And it seemed that's, and there was a lot of weight to it. I think she's really, really good in H2O. You know, and there's that moment in H2O, which I really, I adore. And I got the chills when it happened, when they came face to face through that, you know, you guys know the iconic moment when they come face to face through the door and you see him, you know, they look at each other through the door. That moment, that's a big moment, you know, and they pull it off in that movie. Steve Miner, speaking of Friday the 13th, directed that movie. And I think he had much more of an understanding of what Halloween means and what the characters mean than David Gordon Green and Danny McBride did. So I kept like thinking, how gratifying to me, how gratifying H2O was. Like, I thought the conflict was great. I thought the ending was really, really strong. And I thought that was it. I thought we would never have to have to sit through another Halloween movie again, because I thought the character found closure. You know, Laurie Strode found some closure, and then boom. Now we got this 20 years from that moment. Even though, you know, how H2O in this timeline doesn't exist. Which I also think is weird. Because otherwise, I mean, now, you know, if the other ones existed, Laurie Strode's dead because she got killed in Resurrection. So, yeah. So now in this case, we've got 20 more years adding on to the problems that Jamie Lee character's character is going through, and they give her nothing. The script gives her nothing. She's got unmemorable dialogue. All they did was give her a safe house and a bunch of guns and security, and that's it. And she yells about security and it makes it embarrassing for her family. That's all they've done here. There's no, I mean, like the whole climax at the end, there's no emotional payoff whatsoever. You don't really care about Laurie Strode and her family. The whole subplot with the teenagers was ridiculous. And a lot of those scenes with the teenagers I found incredibly annoying. And yeah, it's really way too violent. And it just doesn't work. It's not scary. There's no suspense whatsoever. And it's a massive, massive, massive disappointment, especially coming from, you know, the fact that Carpenter is executive producer on this one. But Carpenter, you know, they had an interview with Carpenter. Carpenter's like, hey, as long as they pay me. That's all. Carpenter's being very—he's been very honest about that kind of stuff. As long as the check clears. But I will say,
I hope Blumhouse has given him a little bonus taste after this weekend.
Yeah, I hope so too, man. And here's the other thing. Let me say this: the only good thing about this movie is the score. He and his son put together a great score, and I'm not just talking about, you know, the classic Halloween theme. But this is a really great score. Of course, I mean, obviously Carpenter is a fantastic composer, but the score is the only good thing in this movie. Everything else, I mean, it's a really bad movie. A really, really bad movie that I was massively disappointed by. So, yeah, and as a big-time Halloween fan, no. No. It's really bad. Really, really bad and massively disappointing. So, none of us liked it. I don't know. Well, a lot of people saw it, made a lot of money over the weekend, but we knew that was going to happen. It was perfect timing
for it, too.
You know, mm-hmm. Everybody expected those kind of numbers. So, all right, guys, hang on. All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric Childress, Colin Suter are here. We got one more movie to talk about. I wanted to save, I didn't want to close on Halloween. You know, we could have closed on Halloween. It was the biggest movie of the week, but I would rather close on a high note. So that's what we're going to do when we come back. We'll take a break here on 720 WGN. More movie reviews after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. On your weekday mornings. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are talking with Eric and Colin, and let's get the guys back on. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
We should let everybody know, Colin, that this is your last week for a little while. You're going to be taking a little next week is your last week.
Next week.
Next
yeah.
week. Okay, and then you're taking a little time
yes.
off. And Eric won't
yes.
be on next week.
Right.
Right. Where are you going, Eric? Are you going to Vegas?
I'm going to Vegas for the weekend.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So are we going to contact Jim Liskowski maybe? Okay. All right. So we'll get maybe Jim to fill in for Eric while he's off, and then it'll be Colin's last week for a little while until the beginning of the you're going to come in and do the year end.
Yeah, I'll do mid-December stuff.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So. Yeah, a month and a half.
Got it. Okay, cool. Well, we'll miss you, Colin, while you're off.
Oh, I'll miss you, too.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Eric, why don't you tell us about Beautiful Boy?
Okay. Well, this is based on a true story, based on a pair of books, actually, and it stars Steve Carell and Timothée Chalamet. Steve Carell plays a journalist who, as the film opens, will go sort of flash forward and flash back through the story that he's going to tell. He really wants to know what is going on with his son, who has turned into a serious drug addict. Not just the minor stuff, some serious stuff as well. And the movie takes us back and forth through their relationship. They were as father and son. They had a very close, tight-knit relationship, even through divorce that he had. And this movie takes us through the idea of what can a father do for a son that is so deep into his own addiction. And again, not the serious stuff that not easy to get off of. What are the opportunities for rehab and the real emotional connection between a father and son. And what this movie I think does so well. We've seen so many movies about addiction, for whether it be alcohol, drugs, and various other things, where people need to get clean in some manner. We've seen those kind of 12-step type movies before. This one, takes a more difficult path. It's one where you don't exactly see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I think what this movie does really succinctly is really kind of elevate the idea of the non-addicted person's pain. This movie is mostly told from the father's perspective, though we do get a number of individual scenes with the son and exactly where his addiction takes him on his journey. But mostly this is told through the eyes of Steve Carell's character, and we see a father desperately in pain. You know, Carell, recently has been making, quite a side career in these dramatic roles that he's taking of characters who very hard for him to fully express his emotions because he isn't quite in touch with exactly, how he's going to manifest them. And, knowing that his son is going down a path where he is probably going to die and there's nothing he can do for him. He is not a little boy anymore. And, we've seen movies like that before, but I think this movie, in many terms, kind of feels like, that anvil that kind of just presses down on your chest. I'm like, what can he do? What can I do if someone in my life, ends up going down this road? So I think this movie, well, maybe not on an artistic level the way that Requiem for a Dream was, but it has that same sort of visceral impact on your emotions, I think. I think that this movie is in some sort of getting a little too easily dismissed for cliches or something like that. I don't buy into that because I really felt this journey that Carell's character has taken and wanting to understand and whatever he can possibly do when his son goes missing from time to time up to the very painful moment late in the film where he realizes that there might be nothing more he can do for him, and you're kind of waiting for that moment to happen, and when it does, it really is no less devastating. I think this is a really good film about addiction, and I think Carell and particularly Chalamet are both really fantastic in it. I was quite a fan of this movie, much more than I was expecting it to be, and I think it's one of the better movies about the other side of addiction, the addiction to wanting to be the savior, if you will, and possibly failing as a result of it. So I like this movie a lot.
Okay. All right, Colin, what'd you think?
Yeah, I did too, and I think Steve Carell's performance and his side of the story is the most compelling. Just kind of the his arc of having to go from this great loving father who isn't shy about, well, a little shy at first, but will eventually will probably smoke a joint with his son at some point in his life, as depicted in one scene in the film, and to go from just that kind of guy who thinks he's super dad, has gone through life thinking he's this great father, and realizing that there's only so much he could do. And I think that journey is really interesting and thought provoking. And I think this is definitely one of Carell's best dramatic performances. And I mean, really, Chalamet just is asked to do a whole lot here. A lot of this could have been a very showy performance, but I didn't think there was a false note in anything he did in this film. His scenes with Carell, where he's basically asking for help in a very seemingly innocent way, but it's the drugs and the manipulation talking. I mean, he really pulls that stuff off, I think, really beautifully. This was directed by a guy named Felix van Groningen, probably butchering that last name, but now, he made a movie a few years ago called The Broken Circle Breakdown, which I also really liked. And it got kind of buried in the award season of the year it came out. But I think this guy knows how to tap into emotions and then tap into these, these kinds of performances and these kind of delicate situations. And also knows how to use music really well. I think it's a really good soundtrack to this movie. But ultimately, this is a heartbreaker, and I think anchored by two very strong performances.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of Beautiful Boy, and then Eric will stick around, and we will talk about the box office returns right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and we're reviewing the new movies. Right before the break, Eric and Colin both gave positive reviews to Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet's new film, Beautiful Boy. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
I echo everything you guys said about this movie. It destroyed me. It really, really destroyed me. And I think it is, you know, there have been, as Eric, you've already mentioned this, there have been, you know, so many movies about, you know, addiction and recovery, that it seems to be a subgenre unto itself. And some of them are great and some of them aren't. This is a great one. You know, Carell is fantastic. This Timothy Chalamet, man, he's the real deal, man. I mean, this kid is phenomenal, you know, and at such a young age to be able to, you know, really tap into these emotions and play it, also play it really subtle. He's a terrific actor. He's just a terrific actor. And Carell has become a really great dramatic actor. You know, and it's just a joy to watch that guy. And then, you know, when you put somebody like Maura Tierney and Amy Ryan in the movie, that's a cast right there of major pros. But this movie gets the addiction part without a false note. And again, telling it from the point of view of like this guy who just feels completely helpless. There are scenes that are just heartbreaking between the two of them, where he's desperately trying to understand what's going on with his son, and he's desperately sad and really wants to help him and feels completely helpless. And that, you know, that comes off the screen massively and beautifully in the movie. This is a very emotional film. You're going to be very affected by it, and I was deeply moved by it, and it destroyed me. Timothy Chalamet has been doing, you know, the talk show circuit, obviously, to plug the movie, and the guy that he plays is actually okay. He's he's okay now. He recovered, so it's got a happy ending in terms of real life. But not everybody does okay. You know what I mean? Not everybody can survive that. And that's what's harrowing about watching this. And watching this relationship between these two. I mean, some of the flashback stuff is beautiful. And then, I don't know. I just think Carell is really turned into a great dramatic actor. I mean, you take this. I thought Last Flag Flying last year, I thought he was great in that. Foxcatcher, obviously, got an Oscar nomination for that. He's become quite, I mean, you think of Steve Carell as wacky Second City guy and, you know, Michael on The Office, but he really has, he's got great chops. He's turned into a really, really terrific dramatic actor who can stand his ground with, you know, like other great dramatic actors and actresses. And I just think this is a beautiful movie, but it is heartbreaking, I got to say.
Yeah, and we have another Steve Carell movie coming out this year.
It's Zemeckis' new movie.
That's right.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to see it.
It's always great to see Amy Ryan on screen. She's not being utilized enough. But when she shows up in the movie, it does kind of feel like the darkest timeline of The Office.
You know what? I didn't even think of that. Oh, my God. Why? How did I not even think of that? Wow.
This is what happened to Michael Scott and Holly Flock.
I didn't think of that. Wow. Okay. All right. So highly recommended. Highly recommended, Beautiful Boy. So it's only playing in a few theaters, but it's worth seeking out. So definitely. All right. What do we got next week?
What do we have next week?
Oh, we have a Gerard Butler submarine movie.
That's right.
Which I'm schizophrenic about because, how I feel about submarine movies, and you know how I feel about Gerard Butler. So it's a little mixed.
Yeah, you're going to be your emotions are going to be in flux next week.
We have another Johnny.
Can You Ever Forgive Me with Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant?
That comes out, and Johnny. There's another Johnny English movie.
Johnny English Strikes Again. Mid '90s. Jonah Hill's
directorial
new
debut. Yep.
And What They Had with Hilary Swank and Michael Shannon, set in Chicago.
There you go. All right, so that's all coming out next week. Eric, you'll be off next week.
Yes.
And have a good time in Vegas.
Thank you.
As you always do.
I try to.
Yeah, I know. And so there you go. Eric, you hang on. We're going to talk about box office here. Colin, thanks, man. We will talk to you next week.
All righty.
There
Bye-bye.
You go. Colin Suter, everybody. Eric, let's talk box office here.
Yeah.
To no one's surprise, Halloween dominated.
Yeah.
I think everybody knew that. I think you even predicted $70 million or something like that, right?
I thought it was going to do at least in the 60s. I think that's what they were projecting. Over the course of the weekend, the projection started off in the high 70s, like between like 75 and 80. By like sometime on Saturday, they were actually expecting it to best Venom's week, October record from a few weeks ago of over $80 million. And then eventually settled down to 77.5. It's a 50. It's like Blumhouse's like most expensive production, and it still only cost $15 million.
Yeah.
This thing is obviously a massive hit, and the only question now, I think next week, it's going to be an easy number one again next week, the weekend right before Halloween.
Sure.
So it's going to be, it will drop, but I think that, that cushion will, not make it drop so hard. So it'll be an easy number one, and now it's just a matter of, is it going to hit 200 million? And whether it's not going to beat Get Out, which is Blumhouse's highest grossing domestic film to date. So
we'll see what happens.
Both of which are possible.
It was packed when I saw it, and it was packed. I'm trying to figure out. I can't figure out whether the audience liked it or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't. I know that much.
Yeah.
So number two, A Star Is Born, 19.3 million, 126.3 million total, big hit.
Yeah, massive hit. Right now, kind of charting a course for somewhere around 180 million. 200 million still not out of the question, but 180 seems is what the numbers are suggesting right now. You can't scoff at that.
Yeah.
You just can't.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it continues to be the front runner for Best Picture right now. I think it's just the way it's going to play out. People are still flocking to it.
Yeah. Now, and the buzz is so good on it. I don't know. I don't know anybody who didn't like it.
It's the movie. Seriously, everywhere I go, everyone who knows who I am and what I do, it's the one movie they ask me about.
Yeah. Yeah.
The second movie they asked me about is Bohemian Rhapsody, which I said I haven't seen yet.
Number three, Venom, 18.1 million. It's up to $171 million. Solid hit.
Solid hit, yeah. And the only question I have is who are still going to see this movie?
Yeah.
I don't get it. I don't know. I mean, the drops are like 50%. Week to week, which is not bad for a movie that most people think is garbage. So I don't know. Are comic book movies that strong that they can just, they can just survive being garbage?
Yeah.
And this one apparently can.
Yeah. Goosebumps 2 comes in next, the haunted Halloween.
Yeah.
That's $9.7 million.
Yeah. The okay drop, nothing really spectacular one way or the other.
Yeah. Number five, and I can't tell you how disappointed I am by this, is First Man. $8.5 million. It's only made $29.9 million total. And I just...
Yeah.
That's just very
upsetting. Yeah, and its own studio did it no favors this weekend by opening that movie a week before Halloween. Yeah, two different audiences, but First Man lost a lot of IMAX screens this week to Halloween.
See, that's just wrong.
It's just stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just stupid. I mean, if you want to continue to build buzz for First Man, you keep it in the IMAX screens. People
right.
don't need to see Halloween in IMAX. They'll be perfectly not scared in regular theaters.
Right, right.
So the movie, I mean, the critics are going to keep this movie alive. Everyone's on board with this movie. Whether or not something like this is going to affect its Oscar chances, I'm not buying into that just yet. But it's only made $55 million worldwide so far. And it's probably, $50 to $55 million is probably where it's headed right now in the U.S., which is really disappointing.
That's a real shame, man. It really is. That is a real shame. I don't know. By the way, I just want to mention that we have a space expert who's a regular on our show. He's an author. He's written a bunch of books about space. He works with NASA. His name is Rod Pyle, and he loved it. Like from that point of view, he's like, yeah, this is right on. And he just thought it was great. He was not happy about Buzz Aldrin, though, the way they portrayed Buzz Aldrin in the movie.
Does he know Buzz personally?
He did. Yeah, I mean, he's known him. Yeah, he met him, and he's like. But I mean, and he does come off as a bit of a jerk in the movie.
Well, he comes off as a guy that just says whatever is on his
mind.
Well,
and you know, according to
no
Rod,
filter.
And according to Rod, that's how he is in real life.
Well, yeah. Well, so it's an accurate portrayal. And yeah. I guess it's just a matter of if you know he's joking or not.
Right. That's the thing. Right. Number six, The Hate U Give, 7.5 million, bringing its total up to 10.6.
Yeah.
And then let's see, Smallfoot, 6.6. Night School is still hanging in there. Bad Times at the El Royale, another failure.
That's a big failure.
13 million in 2 weeks, and it's such a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then finally,
I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, it was doomed. You know, that number put up last week, it was doomed.
Yep.
I mean, it wasn't for a lack of advertising. They had it out there. I just don't think that people didn't know what to make of it.
I agree. I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I totally agree. And then finally, The Old Man and the Gun, $2.2 million, $4.2 million. But that's in limited, right?
Yeah, it expanded finally wider this week, so it's in like 800 theaters. So it did manage to crack the top 10 finally. And I think it's going to continue to expand for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Fox Searchlight still, still advertising it. I still see commercials for it all over the place. It's expanded. The numbers aren't great for it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, now maybe it's in the top 10. It'll get people talking about it a little bit further, and people will go see it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's another movie that's aimed squarely at adults.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how that one does. Okay. All right, Eric. Well, listen, have a great time in Vegas next week.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you when you get back.
Sounds great.
All right. Eric Childress, everybody. Thanks, buddy. And he'll be back in a couple of weeks. He'll be taking next week off. And then he'll come back in 2 weeks and we'll review more new movies and talk more box office with him. So there's the deal. All right. Let's take a break here on 720 WGN.